Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Pratibha Varkey from the Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Varkey is the Associate Chair of the Department of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic and is a Professor of Preventive Medicine and a Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Medical School. Dr. Varkey also serves as the Medical Director of Ask Mayo Clinic, a national triage service serving over 1.5 million covered lives. She serves on the Board of Trustees of the American College of Medical Quality and the Vice President of the College. She's the editor of two books, and I think what I'll let you do is read more about Dr. Varkey from the bio, and at this point, Dr. Varkey, if I could ask for you to step up. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you all for having me here today. It's truly an honor. In the land of snow that I come from in Minnesota, we traditionally and respectfully consider California as the land of innovations. Terry has alluded to a couple of healthcare-related innovations, but as I think about it, in my daily life, my daily activities, several innovations from California has really changed the way I live my life. So, for example, Google, Apple, entertainment industry, our focus on green and sustainable energy. So it's really an honor for me to be here in the midst of these discussions at the colloquium, and I really look forward to learning from all of you as the day proceeds. I just want to take a moment to pause and salute one of my teachers, Dr. Sheldon Greenfield, who's here in the audience. I hadn't seen him for about 11 years. He tremendously, freed my brain, and was one of the four people that I think have tremendously influenced the way I think of healthcare and healthcare delivery. So thank you, Sheldon. As I thought about my piece of the conversation today, I was tremendously influenced and inspired by the focus of the center on simultaneously transforming healthcare delivery through a simultaneous focus on quality and innovation. And so I thought this morning I would focus on organizational strategies and things we need to consider as we look at systematic implementation of activities to enhance quality and innovation simultaneously. Now, the tension is that they're quite different. In fact, they're quite opposing. The culture, the incentives, the methodologies are quite different. And so how do we do this? Can the same organization do this in the way we are structured currently? Are some of the questions that I hope I will leave you with. So this is a picture of Janus, the Roman god. And Janus is very unique in that he has two heads, eyes simultaneously facing forward and backwards. So he is often considered the god of transitions, and you may be familiar that the month of Januarius is essentially named after Janus. So as we think about the crisis that we are in currently in healthcare, I think it's important to learn from Janus because we really do need to look backward at our current processes, our structures that we have. Look at how can we work in continuously trying to improve our current processes to make it more efficient, effective, cost-effective, and safe, while simultaneously facing forward and thinking about the major strides we need to make, the innovations that we need to introduce to essentially disrupt, maybe cannibalize the processes that we have currently to take us to where we need to go as a nation, as a state, as a county. So here is a survey from May 2011. The results are not surprising. Our sickest patients are often the ones who most frequently delay care due to costs. And this is care, be it seeking or filling a prescription, follow-up for a chronic medical condition, care for a specific medical condition, etc. So in this particular survey, 55% of Californians who had rated their health as fair or poor stated that they had delayed care due to costs. So what a paradox it is, as we know, that we spend 17.6% of our GDP on healthcare, and yet we remain 50th in terms of life expectancy globally. One in four of our four-year-olds is obese. 14% of our population does not have insurance. 15% of our population is suffering from poverty. So what a contrast. We're a rich country and yet have some characteristics of countries that are developing and perhaps are not doing as well. And as we swim in the financial crisis over the last couple of years, it is humbling to note that we as providers, we as physicians, we as healthcare providers and institutions have definitely contributed to the financial crisis in the country. Unnecessary healthcare. There's reports that 32% of what we do as physicians is unnecessary or inappropriate. So this is a study from 2011 published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, suggesting that in 2009, $6.76 billion was spent on non-recommended activities. This is probably just the tip of the iceberg. But simple things like a CBC for 56% of GMEs were not necessary, contributing to $32.7 million. Imaging studies for low back pain were not indicated, $175 million. Or more than $5.8 billion per year in brand in prescribing brand statins instead of generic statins. So lots to fix in terms of unnecessary or inappropriate care. We also know this. We spent most of our time in CPD, in conferences, in UME and GME, and allied health schools talking about what is the right thing to do for our patients. How do you make the right diagnosis? What is the right prescription to provide? What is the right imaging study to order? What is the right test to order? And yet, from a population-based perspective, we know this. Regardless of the specialty that we belong to, we are advanced but not reliable. Americans get only half the care they need. Answers sought in botched transplant. We remember this unfortunate incident of a 17-year-old girl who died following a heart-lung transplant because of an ABO mismatch. The surgery went perfectly. This can happen. This was in Duke University, but can happen in the best of academic centers. And so what was especially disturbing then is a recent study published by Dave Klassen and group from Salt Lake late last year, Health Affairs, suggesting that 33.2% of our admissions in hospitals contribute to adverse events. So basically, one in three of our hospital admissions, we are contributing injury to the patients. So what a world we live in. We come in to heal, but then we leave at the end of the day contributing to injury. Obviously, it is not on purpose. It is large systems issues, complexities that prevail. But the wonderful thing is there has been a lot of work. I think we've reached the tipping point in terms of a focus on quality improvement and patient safety. And there's been a lot of work, at least in specific areas, processes, specific conditions, that has made a tremendous change and impact on the healthcare system. We still have a long ways to go, but we're fortunately here. We're all talking about quality improvement, for example, very different from a world, say, about 15 years back. In the past 4 to 5 years, there's been quite a bit of discussion in terms of contextual factors that contribute to success in systematic success in quality improvement efforts. And this is from an institutional perspective. I think it's interesting to look at it more closely. This is a study published from Cincinnati Children's, August 2011. We often talk about and we acknowledge that factors in QI systems or in microsystems impact the success of QI projects. But really, there are organizational factors that contribute to that as well. In fact, in the business literature, as you look at intra-industry variation in the performance of companies, it is suggested that 40% of inter-company performance differences is essentially related to company culture and company-related factors. So what in our healthcare institutions do we need to remember as we look at systematic influences that contribute to success and quality? And the fascinating thing is it's not just leadership of the QI teams that are engaged in projects, but it's also the senior leaders' project sponsors. So do we have executive sponsorship of QI projects from an institutional perspective seems to be very important. The QI culture, Does the blood of the institution really understand and believe in QI seems to be very important. And then obviously QI skills, QI capability. Do your folks have training and an understanding of the key tools that are needed to create that ultimate success and performance change as it relates to solving complex problems is very important. Jim Collins, in his book on Good to Great in the social sectors, urges us, those of us in social sectors, to consider that greatness is really largely a matter of conscious choice and discipline. And conscious choice and discipline is something I'll come back to, because as we think about QI and innovation, there is really a discipline behind it. And the question is, are we really optimizing the tools and frameworks that we have available for outcomes? And I'd like to I've highlighted four things that I think we're not doing optimally in terms of getting to the 100%, the 99% performance improvement, as opposed to perhaps being okay with 70% improvement. And let me just pause for about 20 seconds and just talk about step two and the tool of benchmarking. Terry alluded to it a little bit. Very, very important, especially in this era of constrained healthcare resources. Are we reinventing the wheel? So is in Mayo Rochester, am I beginning a project which UCSD might have solved already, or at least solved halfway? And where, how can I use the information that's already available in the healthcare systems across institutions and then pick up where they have left off and then take it to the next level? I have often seen that this is a critical missed step. In fact, when I start projects, I often benchmark with non-healthcare industries as well, airline industries, service industries, ice cream shops, veterinary practices. I visit them because you get ideas from these institutions in terms of how they're solving similar problems. And so that's something that I think we want to do systematically if we want to optimize the outcomes that we can get for institutional projects. The other thing I just want to spend a few seconds on is the second last step of cost effectiveness. Typically, as you look at QI training and QI frameworks, cost effectiveness is not a measure that is traditionally taught. I mean, it is obviously part of certain projects, but my encouragement to you is, regardless of the project that you do in, I think it's important to assess cost effectiveness of the same. And it's not just the impact of that particular project or that particular intervention on the process at hand, but also how is it impacting the processes or the systems around it is something that's is especially important as we look at dissemination. Dissemination is an interesting issue as well. So something that has occurred in, say, the preventive medicine clinic in one part of Mayo Clinic, how do I spread it across the institution within 6 to 8 months so that everyone changes practice? And is there actually a framework for that? And the answer is yes. That is also something that needs to be done with discipline. And here is a model that we developed at Mayo from modifications from the work that was done originally at IHI. And as we tested this model through a VTE prophylaxis project, which I'll share with you in a second, we found, again, this idea of executive sponsorship, leadership engagement at the highest levels being extremely important for efficient dissemination of best practices. Social systems, key messengers, how do we get identify opinion leaders to quickly get practices to be engaged in these best practices and change is another question. And then local adaptation to suit the culture or the specialty practices is also critical. So in phase one was the result of the QI project, but then to get from 79.2% defect-free to 98.4% defect-free in an entire institution with multiple specialty practices in less than 8 months took all the steps that I talked about in diffusion. So really consider, as you work on your QI projects, how do you get it across all five academic centers in a short period of time and the conscious discipline that needs to occur for that. So QI culture and QI training was part of the music model that I had presented a couple of minutes back in terms of being critical for systematic success in QI projects. And so then it is obviously, as we know, very disconcerting to realize, as Dave Irby from UCSF, in collaboration with the Carnegie Foundation, states that current medical education does not support the development of capacities we desire and society needs in our physicians. And we really need to focus on population health, quality improvement, and patient safety, and that learners should participate authentically in inquiry, innovation, and improvement in care. So fortunately, in the past, I'd say about 7 to 8 years, tremendous change has occurred in terms of education and QI. And there are several medical schools deliberately focused on introducing this principle from the first day of medical school. And I have just noted a couple of very distinct, different kinds of education. Some are student-driven, most are curriculum or faculty-driven. A couple of years back, we admitted, I was in charge of Block 1 for the medical school, and we admitted all our medical students to the hospital overnight, within the first week of medical school. It was a stark experience for them, because some of them did experience medical errors. This was obviously a simulated environment, but it's a real ward with rounding physicians, nurses, teams. Some of them had Foley catheters strapped to their their low limbs. And the discussions that occurred, we did not introduce a concept of quality improvement, but just going through the process and the stark reality of the healthcare non-system was very evident. But so how do we introduce healthcare as a process, healthcare as a system, the focus beyond disease and management disease to our young future physician leaders is something that I think should not be missed. UCSF has done tremendous work in this area. GME, as you know, ACGME has mandated that quality improvement be taught for every resident and fellow. In fact, 2 out of the 6 mandated competencies relate to QI. So in UCSF, Bobby Barron and I were chatting last year, and he was telling me about this fabulous incentive scorecard system where residents and fellows get incentivized in terms of performance on 3 or 4 quality measures that the institution has decided upon. So what a tremendously innovative way to bring our future physician leaders on board in terms of working together as in teams and thinking about institutional priorities and patient-centered care. In Mayo in 2006, our CEO realized that we really need to make tremendous change in terms of educating all our staff, and this is not just healthcare providers. As the patient walks in through the door of Mayo Clinic, the receptionist who greets the patient, the billing specialist, the linen care, the food care staff, our custodians, all the way to our chairs, and the CEO, all need to be aware of the principles of quality and safety if we really are determined to provide high-quality care to every single patient encounter. And so we created this Quality Academy, which is essentially an in-house training program, a series of training programs, and the team's training program is just one that I've highlighted, where groups of interprofessionals come in with an actual live project that they need to solve, and there is just-in-time training in terms of quality improvement. And this is, since 2006, they have trained 726 staff, and again, staff meaning all employees included, and saved the institution millions of dollars in terms of projects that have come out of this Quality Academy. We're not talking basic skills. We're actually talking about actual engagement in the depth of the best practices of Six Sigma and Lean as they solve real-life complex problems. As of about 16 months back, we introduce another experiment and another culture change, which is fellow certification in quality. And there's different levels, bronze, silver, gold, platinum. And as a start, all residents, fellows, supervisors, chairs, anybody in a management position is now required, it's mandated to be certified at the bronze level. And the bronze level is basically a basic understanding of QI, some of the terminologies, the philosophies, et cetera. But then again, this is an interesting experiment in taking an entire institutional culture and moving it to the next level. It is obviously more meaningful to be engaged in projects, and that is a silver and gold, and that is coming. But just as an example, in about 12 months after implementation, we had 18,890 employees that were certified at the bronze level, 42%. This is the blue part of the bar graph. From Mayo Rochester, for example, were bronze certified, 37% from Mayo Arizona were certified, etc. I'm not proposing this as a solution, but this is just an interesting observation in term, and a starting point for discussions in terms of how do we get everyone on board. So here is this gentleman talking to his slaves and telling them to think about the slave driver as your personal trainer. And what an interesting concept. And what a the reality is we have a hidden crisis, a hidden epidemic in healthcare, which is burnout. One of my roles, as Terry had mentioned, is as associate chair for the Department of Medicine. We have 640 physicians in the department, and a third of them are burnt out. And we know this because we've done extensive surveys. This is something of grave importance to us. We have benchmarked this against other institutions, similar departments, and the numbers are the same. Regardless, in an institution, in an industry where we are people taking care of people, it is very disconcerting to note that our healers are burnt out. So as we introduce change, and that change includes quality improvement activities, the question is, how do we take care of our people? And how do they see this? How do they view the change? And how do they adapt to the change in an era where you're spending 30 minutes already on clerical tasks for every 30 minutes that you spend with the patient? So, you know, it's a very, very complex area that I think deserves much more attention, especially as we are leaders gathered here together. This is a preliminary study that I came across from Massachusetts, looking at practices that had quality improvement activities versus practices that did not. And it is reassuring, at least in a preliminary way, to note that physicians engaged in QI activities or in practices that had QI activities essentially experienced less isolation, less stress, and lower dissatisfaction rates. So that's fabulous. And the postulate was that they're more engaged, they're working in teams, and they're actually solving the problems that they are facing in reality. So I think that's fabulous. But again, let's not forget about the individuals who are in the middle of this change as we propose frequent change. So last week on Monday, I was meeting with my team at Ask Mayo Clinic, and we were talking about our priorities and strategies for 2012 in terms of enhancing our product, which is a national nurse triage line, and looking at how do we make it more cost-effective, how do we decrease pricing for our clients, and how do we think about improving the efficiency in the way care is delivered? And we were feeling pretty thrilled about these three QI projects that we came up with. I came back to my desk, and I was struck and humbled by this email, this newspaper report that was facing me. And I'll just pause for 10 seconds and have you just read this. So here is a program that is offering to call back patients within less than 22 minutes and have access to a U.S.-based board-certified physician who can take care of your health, who can give you prescriptions for $38 per call, and there is no time limit. I was immediately struck with three questions. The first was, oh my gosh, how did they do it? The second question is, why didn't we think of it? And then the third question was a bit of a pause in the sense that as we focus on improving the processes that we are familiar with, are we missing the boat? Maybe we shouldn't be having those processes. We should be thinking about something completely different. And therein lies the conundrum. As we focus on improving operations that we are aware of, i.e. quality improvement, we are a bit distracted in terms of thinking outside the box, the other picture, which is the disruptive innovations that are desperately needed to take us forward. So Clay Christensen, actually before I get to Clay, I came across a study in 2001, Health Affairs, that looked at the top 10 innovations in healthcare. And what was striking to me, although that was not the report, what was striking to me was every single of the 10 innovations related to drugs or procedures or imaging studies. Not a single one was related to healthcare delivery. And isn't that true? If we look at our offices, they have not changed in the last 100 years. We have the same desk, we have the same chair, we have the same couch, we have the the exam table, and if we're lucky, we have a curtain. Things haven't changed. We're still taking care of people who come to us. We're not looking at the community or the state or the nation as a whole, the people that we don't have access to. So herein lies the conundrum as we focus on what we are familiar with in our institutions. And how do we then get to the next level in terms of solving the bigger issues that we've talked about in terms of California or Minnesota or the country? So Clay Christen distinguishes disruptive innovations from sustaining innovations. And for purposes of this talk, I think I'll equate sustaining innovations to very well done QI activities, where the focus is really on enhancing performance. So here we are. Now, disruptive innovations, on the other hand, is interesting because some of these disruptive innovations, as they're introduced, actually have less performance. So they're actually worse off than the processes that exist. On the other hand, customers, patients really like it because they are perhaps less expensive, they are easy to access, just more user-friendly. So herein lies that conundrum of innovation versus quality. Quite different. Now, what is also interesting is that the typical customers that we see or the patients that we see with sustaining, the processes that we have, are quite different from the customers, the patients that might sign up for disruptive innovations. So quite a few differences between the two. Now, sometimes when we talk about innovation, people think about chaos, the idea just erupts, and then everything works wonderfully. It is not like that, right? So there is a conscious discipline involved. There is a framework for innovation as well. This is a framework that we had proposed about 6-7 years back for healthcare. Now, what is important here in the setting of healthcare is we are very much restricted by regulations, by reimbursement, etc. Is part of our daily lives. And so as we look at disruptive innovation, it is not just the innovation that is important. The commercialization piece, the business model of innovation, is extremely important in healthcare to make it successful. So that's the only piece that I'll focus on, but we've written quite a bit on this in terms of tools that need to be used for innovation. But again, the business model is almost as critical in healthcare because of some of the regulatory and reimbursement issues that we face. The enemies of innovation, if you will, lengthy development times, lack of coordination, risk-averse culture. As you see these, and as I talk to my colleagues who run startup companies, and it seems to me, at least, that every 2 to 3 months they come up with new products, new companies. They go through the FDA, have a device approved in 12 months. They have the buy-in of insurance companies for reimbursement. And if I could exaggerate a little bit, it might take me 12 months to take an idea through all the committee structures at Mayo, for example. I'm exaggerating, but you understand the issue. Unfortunately, do we have the agility to do what it takes in academic healthcare institutions? Now, healthcare is challenging. We want to make sure everything is safe. But again, there is this issue of risk, right? So, how do we think outside the box and move things rapidly so that we can actually impact healthcare in ways that we have not dreamt of? So here is the conundrum for academic healthcare institutions. And the question is, are we structured right? This is a wonderful article from HBR 2004. Charles O'Reilly talks about ambidextrous organizations. So they actually looked at 37 different activities from 9 different industries, 14 or 15 different business units. And they looked at structural organization and what contributed to success simultaneously in QI as well as innovation. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have to replace QI with innovation. We need both. And in 90% of the cases, it was the organizations that is labeled here as ambidextrous organizations that were essentially simultaneously successful in QI and innovation. And I'd just like to point a couple of things here. So one is that they are connected at the top. So there is executive sponsorship of both groups. But organizationally, they are separate because you have a different culture, a different mindset, different incentives that are necessary, different processes that are necessary for innovations to succeed as opposed to standardization or improvement. Now, what was also fascinating is in unsupported teams, so this is where the emerging business, I don't know if you can see the dotted line, but it's connected with a dotted line, so not really connected to the leadership. Those don't succeed either. So you really need to be connected at the top because you really need the resources and the buy-in and the support of the executive leadership. But interestingly enough, in this particular study, it was the organizations that were separate but under the leadership that really were successful in both QI and innovation. So the question is, are we missing a big piece of the puzzle in academic health centers and in healthcare organizations? This is a very old classic model looking at adult populations at risk versus the patients that we see that are referred to a university medical center. This is from 1961 NEJM. There's a more recent version, but I'd like to stick to the classic version because I think the philosophy is the same. So if you have a particular disease and you have 1,000 people at risk for the disease, only one, that is that small black square that you see, only one of these patients is seen in an academic health center. So again, when we talk about disruptive innovations and changing healthcare at large, you know, therein lies the issue at hand, right? We're still focused on the patients that we see or that we come in contact with. There is no question that IT is going to play a significant role in disruptive innovation in the future. This is from the California survey that was done last year. 59% of Californians in this particular study had searched online for information about a disease or medical problem. Third graph, 27% had used an online personal health record. I suspect this is more in Kaiser, for example, and definitely less in states like Minnesota where it's not as popular. So again, IT is definitely part of the puzzle, and the question is how is this going to evolve? This is the largest randomized controlled trial being done with telehealth and telemed. This is from UK. The study itself has not been released. There have been some initial reports about outcomes, or actually projected outcomes, that have been released. This is from March 2012. And Paul Bourceau is essentially a UK health minister. And you may know that the National Health Services, they have a national telemed, telehealth care. And they're predicting that with the use of this, that they can save about £1.2 billion over 5 years, 20% fall in emergency admissions, etc. And we know this, for example, at Asmeo Clinic, and just this particular client, about 700,000 covered lives, 56% of the time we were able to divert original intent of ER visits to lower care. So again, how do we use non-traditional methodologies where we don't see these patients, they are not even part of our academic health centers, but perhaps are located nationally or in the state, and use alternative models to provide good care and cost-effective care. There is no question that social links, social networks is going to play a major role in disruptive innovations in the future. There are some pilots taking place right now. I don't know how it's going to evolve. I've not really seen any major outcomes as yet in terms of wellness. I know there are some studies being done on obesity and chronic diseases that have had some outcomes. If you're not aware of this, this is a rather interesting experiment, a series of experiments being done in Maryland on a state level from the public health department, again, engaging the community. Here's the first example, rather interesting, a collaboration between the fire department and healthcare access. And basically targeting frequent 911 callers and introducing caseworkers and nurses who visit these frequent callers at home. And look at the tremendous response in terms of this intervention. 32% decrease in transport responses, 79% decrease in non-transport responses, et cetera. So very intriguing. So the question is, you know, isn't it time to turn the pyramid upside down? We, in the industrial age, have focused and have at least reimbursed tertiary more than secondary, more than primary care. In the information age, shouldn't it be the other way around? So individual self-management, friends and family, social networks, and then the actual interaction with the professionals being reserved for the more sick patients. Oh, crap, was that today? We certainly don't want to miss the boat. We are definitely in the midst of a crisis, and there's a lot to do. Let us, you know, roll up our sleeves and dive in. There's a lot of work to do. So to summarize, we have talked about, this is the Sandcone theory borrowed from operations management. Quality being the base of the Sandcone, very important as we consider in healthcare issues surrounding dependability, reliability, efficiency or speed, cost effectiveness and safety. So we desperately need quality to be the base of everything that we do in healthcare as we see it. But on the other hand, this is something that we did with some of my colleagues in pathology. As we look at the future, it's not just enough to focus on standardization or improvement of operations as we see it. We really need to take it to the next level, which is innovation. So again, the conundrum of innovation and quality, and let's embrace both and take healthcare to the next level. I think it would be fair to say that we are in the midst of a perfect storm. And the things we fear most in organizations, fluctuations, disturbances, imbalances, are definitely the primary sources of creativity. So congratulations to all of you, Terry and the board, for this wonderful meeting. Congratulations to all of you for the work that you're doing, and thank you again for having me be part of this discussion.
Sure, if this is on. It is. Good. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Varkey, and we're glad that the rain stopped and we could give you a little bit of California sunshine. We have a few minutes for Q&A, and I'd like to, if I may, ask the first question. We know that in addition to the wonderful work that you're all doing in quality, there is also a standalone innovation center at the Mayo. Could you give me an example of some work that's taking place there?
Thank you. So the question was, Mayo does have a Center for Innovation and the work, some of the work that we're doing there. The concept evolved, and I was fortunate to be part of the original team that created the center about 8-9 years back. I'm no longer part of the center. But the concept was, okay, how do we create disruptive innovations while the rest of the clinic is focusing on quality improvement and enhancing operations. The focus is definitely on interprofessional teams that work together. This includes folks who are design experts, engineers, in addition to the traditional healthcare providers, that come together to look at, okay, where do we need to take healthcare? So we spent quite a few years trying to formalize the innovation methodology, if you will. A recent innovation that I think is rather disruptive, from about 16 months back, I don't believe it has been published. I know there was a little write-up about it in the HRQ M&M the web pages, is something called the e-consult, and I have permission to share that. So this is basically a physician-to-physician consult that does not require seeing the patient. So as a preventist, I might send a physician order entry. So this is just in the electronic medical record, a request for a hematologist to give me an opinion on, let's say, an SPEP that was abnormal. And within 1 to 2 days, the hematologist will look at, because we have a shared EMR, look at my notes, look at my clinical examination, the history, and everything in terms of lab work and imaging studies, and give me a very detailed note that is also in the electronic medical record of their recommendations on how this patient should be treated. So essentially, you have the same outcome as you would if the physician was seeing the patient face-to-face, and yet you have a release of access that is then saved for the patients who truly need that face-to-face intervention. This actually started out as an employee intervention because, as Terry had alluded to, healthcare costs for employees are tremendous. We have over 35,000 employees in Rochester, 56,000 across the Mayo Health System. So we do not charge our employees anything for this kind of specialty consult. It is a true specialty consult. For our patients who come into Mayo and require specialty consults and we're unable to get them either to see the specialist or we feel that it does not require a face-to-face visit, we essentially charge $50 out of pocket. So the question is, and we had a brief discussion about this, Terry and I, so you're losing that the money that you would have got from the consult. But again, if we think outside the box and think about serving our patients, and looking at cost savings, looking at increasing access, here is an innovative disruption. It has taken on as wildfire. We have now 134 diagnoses that can be can be managed this way or is amenable to e-consults. Some of them do require follow-up face-to-face consults. We have taken this outside of the institution. Now, most recently, over the last couple of months, we have international patients that we have not seen before. So we have primary care providers based in Canada, for example, who are then interacting with our specialists for information and consults through this mechanism. The business model there is slightly different. But again, I think that's a nice example of a disruptive innovation, just 16 months, so we're still trying to learn and modify it as we go. We've had at least 10,000 e-consults thus far as of a couple of months back. So,
thank you. I see several of our colleagues taking notes, so thank you. We have time for two short questions. We have a microphone in the back. If anyone would like to step up and ask a question, thank you.
Good afternoon or good morning. I'm Claire Brindis at UCSF at the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies, and thanks so much for your remarks. I was wondering how Mayo is dealing with the perverse incentives problem that we have while we're trying to introduce incentives in terms of reduced hospitalization days, et cetera. Thank you.
It's a tough question. We don't have, a fully defined answer, but this is something that we're very carefully looking at. For example, dialysis, the Medicare bundle payment that is coming up pretty soon. We have been working on it at least for a couple of years now, anticipating that. And we're looking at very different alternative models in terms of, okay, let's do what is right for the patient and let's not deliver care as we have. In the hospital, we've saved, I don't remember the exact numbers, but millions of dollars in terms of readmissions by changing the way we practice, by closer care coordination, by integrating information technology in terms of alerting providers, whose patients are being readmitted, et cetera. So we are trying to look at this very differently and trying carefully, although being aware of incentives, trying carefully to think outside the box, not be distracted by those, and try to do what is right for the patient. That is my simple answer to a very complex question, which we fully haven't figured out yet.
Hi, I'm Julia Walsh. I'm on the faculty of UC Berkeley at the School of Public Health. Stated that your quality team educational system had saved Mayo vast amounts of money, but did not then document that. I'm curious how you documented it and how much it actually did save, since that's this impinges on Claire's question about perverse incentives, because quality may mean that you can charge less. So I would love some more information about that,
yeah.
Please.
I don't have the exact figures. I know as of about 3 years into starting the Quality Academy, I heard numbers of around $7 to $8 million. It has exponentially taken off since then, so the number of projects is much more, and I don't have the exact numbers. But this is something that we try to build in terms of measuring cost savings as part of the QI projects.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Varkey.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you. So delighted. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.